Phoebe Robinson had a really good feeling as 2019 drew to a close. After 2 years of a long-distance relationship, her boyfriend decided to come off the road as a tour manager for a band and start a travel business so they could finally experience some real time together. Robinson, whose career as a performer and producer often put her on the road, was excited to just do normal stuff for a while. Nights out together that didn't require weeks of scheduling, visits from his mom, just going to the grocery store together sounded nice. Then the new year arrived, and as we all know, 2020 had other plans for all of us. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Robinson lives in New York, which meant sheltering in place for a long time in pretty tight quarters. They were both working from home in a space not designed to function as a dual home office, which we all know is not easy. But fortunately for us, Robinson threw some of her considerable energy into a new collection of essays called Please Don't Sit on My Bed in Your Outside Clothes. Phoebe Robinson is a writer, actor, producer, and stand-up comedian, co-creator and co-star of the podcast and TV show Two Dope Queens, among other things. Phoebe, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so what did you imagine 2020 would be like for you before everything got so chaotic?
Yeah, I mean, I just was imagining more of the same, just steadily working, you know, have my Comedy Central show that was getting ready to come out. We're going to finish shooting some last episodes, my stand-up special, and you know, just spending time with the BF and just like sort of just kind of having like a nice sort of normal regular year with sort of like career ups and downs, but nothing out of the ordinary, I think.
You were sort of stunned to discover that some people viewed like business closures and stay-at-home orders like some kind of civil rights violation, while others ended up not having the ability to stay home and suffered for it.
Yeah, I just feel like when all of this was happening last spring, there was so much just selfishness that was displayed that I was really kind of shocked by. Like, to me, I was just like, you know, my boyfriend and I, we were fortunate enough to be in a position where we have like an apartment that we can shelter in. So we didn't understand how people were just sort of like, well, I still want to go on vacation. I still want to do this. I still want to travel internationally. It's like, yeah, we all want to do that, but there's something bigger going on than what our wants are. And the fact that we have the luxury to be able to shelter in place safely, and some people do not, I just was sort of like, so many people were just missing the big picture. And we're sort of kind of complaining about how their quote unquote freedoms were being taken away. And most of those people that were complaining, I'm like, you don't even know what it's like to not have a home. You don't know what it's like to live with someone who's abusive, where it's not safe for you to stay at home. And so if you do have the luxury and privilege of staying home, which will benefit the essential workers, then why, to me, it's like, why wouldn't you do it?
You and your boyfriend had not been living together or even living in the same city for very long before quarantine lockdown started. That has to be a real test of a relationship.
Yeah, we moved in together August 2018, and he was still full into his tour with the Lumineers. They went until the end of 2019, and I had started my stand-up tour at the beginning of 2019. So yeah, we were sort of, we had a home together, but you know, we were sort of there together for like a week or 10 days and then he was gone or I was gone. So to switch from that to, you know, 15 months of just unfiltered interaction, it was of course an adjustment at first, and you really feel the tightness of being in a New York City apartment and you don't have a balcony and all those things. So at first it was definitely an adjustment, and it was probably even more so of an adjustment for him. He's been touring since he was 17 around the world. So to have that sort of be like your everyday life to then just being in Brooklyn for 15 months straight, I think was also sort of like, hey, what's going on here? This is strange kind of feeling.
Because you're a famous person, Apartment Therapy did a whole spread on your place. And it is, I have to say, it's gorgeous, but it isn't really big. What did you do to get space from one another when the physical space you were sharing was pretty small?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that helped is we have different, like I tend to wake up earlier than he does when he's not on the road. So I was able in the mornings to just sort of go into our shared office and make a cup of tea and do some reading, and I can close the door. We definitely would just tell each other, hey, I need a little bit of alone time. So that he's a big, gamer, so he, would go into the office and play his video games with his friends from back in the UK. And then, sometimes I would go for a walk. Like we really tried to sort of give each other space, but we also still wanted to make sure we were doing things such as like a date night or whatever. So it's not just kind of us, just behaving as roommates, and still want to have that sort of romantic connection.
You also had to get comfortable, I guess, with not always being your best with one another. I wonder about the pros and cons of that bit of mystery that exists in a lot of relationships being impossible when you're sort of shut up together for so long.
Oh yeah, there is no like, oh, it's so sexy. Like, like we're hearing each other like pass gas, like it just like you're seeing the same person with crust in their eyes for 15 months straight. Like it's not, like people always joke like, oh, you guys must be, fooling around all the time. And I was just like, what? Have you ever wanted to sleep with someone all the time when you see them all the time? Like that's just not, reality. And so I think there was a level of, sort of like adjusting to, I think when you are dating long distance or you spend a lot of time apart, when you do come together, everything feels like it has to be like super romantic and like super special. So everyone's on their best behavior. And then so we sort of went from kind of that sort of living like a low budget, we're on the bachelor lifestyle where we're in like a different city and it's romantic to living together every day. But I think in us being quarantined like that for 15 months, that to me is when we became best friends. And I don't think that we truly were until that point.
All right, I want to shift gears here a little bit. You don't plan to be a mother, despite being raised in a society that assumes every woman will want this eventually and may not be a full, sort of complete woman if she doesn't. You grew up shaped by the assumption that you would eventually want kids. How did you realize actually you didn't?
Yeah, I think it was kind of, I just never really felt that, people always say like you're that maternal like clock sort of happening where I'm kind of like, oh my gosh, I think I want to have kids. And but I just sort of assumed like, oh, that'll just come eventually. And so I'll just keep bopping around doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life work-wise, and then one day it'll just kick in and that need for me to be a mother will happen. And it didn't. And I was just sort of like, oh, instead of me going, okay, yeah, that just means that I don't want to have kids, I was like, oh, well, there must be something wrong with me. Like, why don't I want to be a mother? Clearly I'm not nurturing. Clearly I'm broken. Clearly I'm like all these like horrible things that people say about women who choose to be child-free. And yeah, I really had to sort of like work through that and go, wait a minute, why is it automatically that I'm a horrible person if I don't want to have a child? Why is it all the automatic assumption that I'm not really doing my duty as a woman if I don't want to have kids? And so I really had to sort of like stop and sort of look at the loop of negativity that was, ingrained in me, and sort of like break that down and be like, wait a minute. Like I'm doing plenty of good things with my life. I'm helpful in many ways. I'm nurturing in many ways. And so I really had to sort of take stock of that and be like, don't discount myself or don't write myself off just because I don't want to be a mother. And it made me think that there's so many women who either choose to be child-free or for a number of circumstances cannot be mothers. And I think it's very painful when sort of the perception is that you are not really a woman if you are not married, you're not straight, you don't have kids. And I think society is so judgmental of women, and it's really difficult for so many women to sort of just survive a society as it is without all these standards being placed upon them. And And writing this essay, I just wanted to let those women know, like, hey, you're not alone. I'm with you. Don't let anyone make you feel bad about yourself because of a choice that you made that is for the betterment of your life.
So, in addition to your writing and performing careers, you are, in your words, building a mini empire. How did you decide you wanted to start a production company with a literary imprint division?
Well, I always imagined doing, starting my production company like in my 40s, like mid to late 40s or whatever. And after the second batch of Two Dope Queens specials dropped on HBO, I was just kind of like, okay, this is going to be the time where I'm really going to refocus on developing my own sort of half-hour comedy. I've been trying to do that off and on for a few years, and nothing I've really like materialized or panned out because of timing and a bunch of other things. And so around that time, ABC reached out to me about this pilot, and they wanted me to star in it. And I liked it. I thought the script was funny, but so much of my career is sort of self-generating stuff where, I'm either the producer or something, I'm a writer on something, in addition to being in front of the camera. And so to me, it just felt like for me to just be an actor who's just gonna come in, say the lines, and then leave, that just didn't feel as creatively enriching to me. So I said pass. But I was like, thank you so much for thinking of me. I really appreciate that. And then like a couple of months later, they were like, well, how would you feel about starting your own production company? And I was like, I can tell you guys no, and you will offer me a better job. So I was kind of like shocked, and I was like, all right, I wasn't planning on this happening now, but let's go for it. And so I started assembling my team together, and I hired Jose Acevedo from Comedy Central to come over and be my head of development. And then, around that time, I'd always been thinking about launching an imprint. Like, it's a dream of mine that I've had since 2014. And so I was always sort of like, oh, it's never the right time. But my lit agent, Robert, and I kept talking about it. And we had a call with Plume before COVID, to sort of just kind of like see like what's up and like how we can make this happen. And then when COVID happened, I was like, oh, there are way more important things than me starting an imprint. But I just realized how much I loved reading books during COVID. And so I was like, well, maybe we should revisit this and this might be the right time. So it's one of those things where nothing was ever specifically planned as I'm going to do this in 2019 or I'm going to do this in 2020. But it really just came together, I think, when it was supposed to. I think the universe knew more than I did. So it knew like that I could handle all this stuff.
I know that you want to feature the kind of writers who have been underrepresented in traditional publishing, which is to say a lot of people. You can't publish them all. How hard is it to turn some writers down? How do you make decisions?
I want to say it's not, I thought it was going to be horrible turning someone down. It's really not difficult just because being on this other, like when I was on the other side only as like a creator, I was just like, what is the process? And sometimes you can tell someone's, they're being sexist or they're being racist, and that's why they're passing on you. But like being on the other side of it, it's really, I could sort of go, oh, this book is great, but I don't think I should be the person to publish it. Like, it's just doesn't fit with what my brand is. Like, there was this one book that was really cute, but it skewed religious. And I was just like, I'm not really a religious person. And it's like, I was like, this should go to an imprint that's really going to knock it out the park. And I just don't think that I would or could. So I'm only ever passing on people if I just think it's not the right fit. It's never like, oh, you're a terrible writer and you should quit, or or you're a guy and I hate men and I don't want to publish men. It's never that. So it really just being on this side of it just really makes me, you just kind of go with your gut and whatever you respond to. And if you don't respond to it, it doesn't mean that it's not good. It just means that it's not for you. And it's good to know that as opposed to me trying to publish everything and doing some authors a disservice because I'm not able to represent their work as perfectly as I should as a publisher.
One interesting thing you've had to deal with that I hadn't really considered was the conventional wisdom that says Black women seeking leadership roles essentially encounter endless roadblocks. Like, it is, I think, really important to acknowledge challenges, but it sounds like if we're not careful, all that could actually act as a deterrent to young Black women with a great deal of potential.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard if, you know, you grow up never seeing, and you're a Black girl and you grow up and you never see Black women in leadership positions. You internalize that, whether you know it or not, you know what I mean? And I think whenever people sort of discount the whole notion of, you know, representation matters, I always counter, well, if it didn't matter, then most people would be represented. But if we notice that it's mostly just straight white men who are represented, that is for a reason. So I think we just need to acknowledge that representation does matter and is really important to the development of everyone, not just Black girls, but, you know, white men need to also have Black women, Latina women, Asian women as in leadership positions above them, so they understand that that is also a thing that happens in the world. So, you know, when I was starting my own business, I never had a Black woman as a boss. I only had one Black woman as a teacher, and I think that was like in middle school. I had one Black woman as a teacher in middle school, and then in college I had one Black man as a teacher, and I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. This was 2002 to 2006. This, you know what I mean?
It's not ancient history, right?
Yeah, it shouldn't be like that. So for me, it's really important as a Black female boss to sort of acknowledge that, sadly, I'm in sort of rarefied air. And I also want to do as much good as possible as I can in the position that I have, because I worked hard to be here. And I don't want to be the only one here. But it's really sort of, I think it's really hard to sort of kind of try to achieve things if you don't see anyone who looks like you doing it.
You have had to come to terms with the fact that building your dream business doesn't necessarily translate to whatever enthusiasm your employees bring to the job. Like, for some of them, working for you is still going to be just working. How did you learn not to take that personally?
I think I was just sort of like, excuse me. I think it was sort of like, you know, when I was an assistant, I wanted to be a stand-up comic. You know, this was just to pay the bills. And I'm like, for some people, they see me as someone to just help them pay their bills. So having that sort of reminder allowed me to be like, oh yeah, they're not going, Phoebe Robinson sucks and this job is garbage. They're just going, I have my own dreams too, just like Phoebe has her dreams. And my dream is to be a writer or to work in production or to do a multitude of things. And so for me, I understand that as long as you show up and you're doing the job that you're paid to do, great. This doesn't have to be your passion, but I want you to feel good about the work that you are doing. And I want to also be able to help people. Like, it would be nice if, like, this job, like, working for me, like, being my assistant or what have you, is sort of a stepping stone to, like, an amazing career. Like, I'm honored to be a part of that journey. And so I think it just having compassion and sort of remembering where I was when I was in my 20s, I can't believe I'm saying that. But, you know, to remember, like, what my mindset was when I was 24, 25, and I was hustling in the city, and just be like, oh, they have that mindset, too, and it's not anything personal.
So you explain in the book that your parents are not big travelers. Has it surprised you to realize how much, when it's possible, how much travel feeds your soul?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think that was going to be something that was going to happen when I started traveling seriously in 2017. I was just sort of like, I'm from the Midwest, you know, I've lived in Brooklyn since I was 17. I kind of want to see the world, you know, I want to travel the world seeing you too as well. They're my favorite band. But, you know, also my boyfriend he's from the UK and he's seen the world, and he's just like, oh, one of my favorite places is Prague, and in this city I did this and blah blah blah. And so it just, he has such an amazingly adventurous and colorful life, and he's only 33. And so I was just sort of like, oh wow, this guy is really cool, and his whole life changed because he started traveling at 17. And so for me, I was definitely like, I want to have some of that life-changing stuff happening too, and I want to try different food, and I want to learn about myself, and I want to look at different art and all this other stuff. And you know, for the longest time, I couldn't afford to do any of that financially. And I just, you know, as a woman, it's always like terrifying to just sort of travel alone a little bit, because you just worry that something bad is going to happen to you. So when I got the opportunity to travel, I just really sort of felt like I was on, you know, like when you play video games and you like unlocked another level. That's really how I felt. I was like, oh, this is like a new level of my life. And so I really can't wait to go back and travel again, because it's just really so special. And I think it's made me a much better person.
Your chapter on performative allyship or performative activism was really compelling. First of all, how do you define these things?
Yeah, I think my definition of performative allyship is sort of, you know, and it's not just limited to race, I just want to say, but I think it was very much my essay in this book was in response to what happened last summer following George Floyd being murdered. And just, you know, people are rushing to social media to post a black square, or they're buying, you know, Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility and taking pictures of it, being like, you should read this book, and feeling as though something was accomplished because of that. And making all these grandiose proclamations, and we're going to be there for you, we're going to change our hiring practices, and then nothing in action was actually changed. And there was so much of that last summer that it was really kind of, at first it was like, this is weird. Then it was just kind of funny, because I was like, this is so insane that people don't realize how ignorant this is. And then it just made me mad, because I was like, this is now just taking up so much airtime from like the true activists who have been doing work for years and decades.
One of the points you make is that reading books on anti-racism, I mean, your preference is black writers rather than white writers like Robin DiAngelo, but that's all well and good. But like a diet of only those can limit people's perspective on blackness to only the aspects that have been shaped by white racism.
Yeah, I mean, last year when there was the whole there's a publishing paid me that hashtag on social media, and then when people were trying to black out the New York Times bestsellers list, it was like people were only buying anti-racism books by black authors. I was like, yes, this is very important. Like, you know, I appreciate you buying those books, but what about books by black authors that are coming of age stories, or romantic comedies, or thrillers, or you know, just a whole wide range of topics have nothing to do with black trauma at the hands of white authority figures, systemic racism. And so if that's all you're sort of digesting, your understanding of blackness is going to be pain and suffering. And there's so much more to tell about the black experience than those topics. And I think it could just sort of like wade in this sort of like sorrow, as of like, oh well, I'm so grateful for my life because it's not this. And that to me, I find to be problematic and patronizing, and just, you know, the wrong way to go about it.
You do note that at times during quarantine, especially as you and everyone were absorbing the horror of George Floyd's murder, it occurred to you that it might have been nice to have another person of color quarantine with you. How did you think that might have made your experience different?
I think it's just sort of those kind of unspoken moments, and can just sort of, you know, I was waking up sort of with a cloud over my head. Even if I was having a pleasant day, that was still always sort of in the back of my mind, in a way that if you're not black and you're watching all of these black people be murdered by the police, you're just not, it's not going to be top of mind for you in that way. And you know, at certain points we have like sort of police cavalcade sort of driving up and down our street in Brooklyn, and you know, he could step outside and go to the grocery store and be like, yeah, that's ridiculous, the police are driving, but not feel threatened in a way that, like, as a black person last summer, if you just saw the police rolling up and down your street, that was to intimidate you, not so you could feel comforted. So it's just those things that are kind of like, because his skin is a different color, he just is not have to think about it in that way, and it doesn't necessarily affect his day to day.
Aside from race, what is the sort of culture gap between an American and a British person in an intimate relationship? I mean, is it always just sort of funny the ways that you're from different cultures and you interpret things differently? Or are there ever times when you actually misunderstand one another?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is funny. I think the big thing that we sort of addressed early on was our communication styles. You know, I am a loud American, and you know, certainly when we started dating, he's less quiet now, but when we started dating, it was a little bit of that, you know, stiff British upper lip, and I was just kind of like, dog, like, we gotta talk. You can't just be, you know, so like put together, buttoned up, and so I kind of had to learn how to take my energy down sometimes. And he had to sort of learn how to just really like open up and be loose and fun. He's so funny, and he has such a wicked sense of humor, and he's like this amazing combination of like super duper nerd, but has like a crap load of tattoos and all kinds of stuff. And then there's sort of like the lighter things where, you know, T, I just apparently, according to his family, I do not know how to properly have tea. So it's just funny to see those sort of like cultural differences. And then also just certain things that, you know, to me, like, especially when I was a kid, like growing up, like black culture was like so pervasive. Like, even if you weren't black, you sort of, you knew about shows like Moesha and Martin, or like you listened to Lil' Kim or whatever. And so he would be like, who's Lil' Kim? And I was like, oh, buckle up, babe, buckle up. And he be, I played a song for him. I think it was How Many Licks. I just went in. I went in, just, I'm not gonna hold back. I was like, you need to start with this. And he goes, this song is very intense.
What was wrong with the way you drank tea?
So, and I say this with love, the Brits love drinking tea that tastes like dirty dishwater. And I like, you know, a standard issue, you know, green Lipton tea with some honey in it. And they were just like, you put honey in your tea? What? You drink Lipton tea? They're like into like English breakfast or PG Tibbs, you know, with just like a spot of milk. And I'm like, this is gross. This is terrible. So, you know, there was a lot. They accept my tea, but they call it a concoction.
I kind of like that you called it a spot of milk. Clearly, he's influencing you in some ways.
He is.
I loved your chapter on self-care. In some ways, I feel like I could have written parts of it because it speaks to the way that self-care has been turned into this luxury commodity, and yet there are so many people suffering deeply because they can't afford actual health care, mental health care.
Yeah. And, you know, I wrote that just because I think everyone was talking about self-care so much all the time, and for a while, at least for a few years. And, you know, I would be asked in interviews, like, what's the self-care? You know, and people say stuff like I would even say it too, like a candle or a bubble bath. And, you know, it was just sort of during COVID, I was like, you know, I don't think this Diptyque candle is solving problems for people, you know? And even though it's nice to smell something good, and I'm not like saying don't have those moments of pampering, but you know, I started going to therapy. My boyfriend and I, we do like couples therapy like once a month, just to sort of like just, and it's not like anything major or intense is going on. It's just sort of like figuring out communication styles, figuring out like what you're bringing to the relationship that has nothing to do with the other person, and just having sort of that source of someone to talk to who can help you sort of work through your habits, really have you think about your actions and those sorts of things. Like, that is not going to be solved by buying a cute notebook off of Etsy, even though I currently at least have 20 notebooks. And I really want us to sort of go back to sort of the radical roots of self-care, that, you know, the Black Panthers and Audre Lorde were really talking about and advocating. And I think we got away from that once capitalism got involved. And you sort of see that, like, we're all spending money to quote unquote feel better, but I felt like we're all sort of still either stressed out or feeling worse. And so it just made me think maybe self-care industry is not really all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I also think, you know, those of us for whom the fancy candle or the bubble bath or whatever, the box of chocolates solve our problems are likely to sort of overestimate what's wrong with our lives to the detriment of paying attention to anyone else's.
Yeah, because you get so caught up in like, okay, you know, I'm gonna do my sleep app so I can track how much I'm sleeping. I'm gonna, you know, get the candles, get the notebooks, you know, go to the retreats, do yoga with my girlfriends. And then, you know, the people who genuinely need help, that, you know, actual therapy would help, and those folks, like, that's not accessible to them. And so I wrote in the book, I was like, I understand that me saying that I have a therapist, I realize that is a privilege, and I don't want to you know, take that lightly. And so to me, I just feel like there are so many people who are actually being let down by the healthcare system, by the fact that we still in this day and age don't truly understand that mental health is, you know, is in a state of emergency in this country, and that it really needs to be prioritized. And like, yes, I'm all for, you know, I have my Peloton, I love doing my Peloton classes, and we all like to talk about exercising and stuff, but it's like we also need to talk about how we have to take care of ourselves mentally, and nobody wants to really do that in a way that's really going to benefit the majority of the people in this country. And that to me is what I think is so problematic, that it's like, well, if you could spend the money to get those things, then maybe you'll be better. But if you can't afford it, you know, oh well, sorry. Thanks for playing.
I think you get credit for still using your Peloton, by the way. I'm waiting for the second round when people realize they haven't been on these things in a year, and then I can buy one cheap. Has
I'll hook you up.
the pandemic, I mean, you've been going 200 miles an hour for years and years and years. I only have about 30 seconds to give you on answering this, but has the pandemic changed the way you plan for the future?
Yes, I think I have done a much better job of reprioritizing my life, where work is not just the number one thing. Like, I'm FaceTime with my friends more. I'm seeking out for a brunch here and there with friends. I'm, you know, spending more time with my boyfriend and just really trying to have fun as opposed to just working all the time.
Phoebe Robinson is a writer, actor, producer, and stand-up comedian. Her new book of essays is titled Please Don't Sit on My Bed in Your Outside Clothes. Phoebe, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time to talk with us.
Thank you for letting me chat, and sorry all my answers were so long.
It's NPR. They were perfect. You will find the Think Podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe, or listen at our website, think.kera.org. You can follow the show on Twitter at KERA Think, or follow me at Chris Boyd Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.